And we've got quite a few questions here, so hopefully we can sift through these in a reasonable amount of time. I'm going to try to read the question, and then I'll pass it to somebody that that this is relevant to the material that they presented, if that is the case. Some of the more general questions, well, we might just pass it around as they'll come up to the microphone to answer the question, and we'll just see how this works. All right, this one's going to be for Mike. Is this on? Can you hear me back there? Can you hear me now? How about it? It's come up here. Okay, what effects do the assertions of climate change science have on carbon to carbon 14 ratios? Well, there's really a second question here, but Mike, I'm going to let you answer that one first if you want.
Well, be very careful to answer this. You know, one of the things that we can actually measure is that the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere are increasing, and that CO2 or the carbon for that CO2 is coming from the burning of fossil fuels. Those fossil fuels typically have a lower ratio of carbon 14 to carbon than we see up in the biosphere. And so that was, again, from a biblical standpoint, we view that as kind of the pre-flood ratios, you know, because that's when a lot of the fossil fuels were buried. And so what is happening is the carbon 14 to carbon ratio will be decreasing, you know, based on the increased CO2 in the atmosphere. And then so I think that would be, it's not really an effect, doesn't really matter on the climate change, but it's just as we do see CO2 levels increasing, that will happen. When we were doing above ground nuclear testing, that also had changes to the carbon 14 to carbon ratio. So those are really just, I guess, ways that ratio could be changed. But as far as how any of the assumptions or any of the work that's being done in the climate change area, that's not really going to be affected by that ratio. Unless I'm missing the point of the question, I don't see any way that would be in effect.
Okay, Mike, I guess go ahead and stay up here. If, as NCSE claims, C14 has fluctuated. Some of these people write like scientists. Fluctuated up and down. What does this do to climate science? Do the fields contradict each other?
If the person asking the question, if they had a something specific in mind, yeah, I'd be happy to try to address that. Off the top of my head, I can't see how that would be a contradiction. We do know that the carbon 14 to carbon ratio fluctuates, and again, gave several examples of how you could have major fluctuations throughout history, which of course, strongly affects carbon dating. But as far as how that ratio could affect actual climate change, because the climate change is typically based on the total amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, at least that's one of the drivers for climate change, then if I'm changing, you know, fluctuating around this one part per trillion carbon 14 in the atmosphere, that fluctuation, that one part per trillion, if it was half a part per trillion or two parts per trillion, it's still a very minor part of the carbon in the atmosphere. So it wouldn't have an effect on the overall change that people are investigating.
Mike, just stay on up here. We're going to load you all down with all these dating questions. Is carbon dating based on some assumption? I know you did talk about this briefly, but you might summarize that. Is carbon dating based on some assumption?
Yeah, the main assumption on carbon dating is I have to know what the carbon 14 to carbon ratio was at the time the sample was created, I guess you would say. And so typically where the contradictions come into play, you find a lot of times like wooden bowls, wooden spoons from a time very close to the flood, we can measure what the carbon 14 to carbon ratio is in those, but we really don't know what it was originally. And since we would expect to have very different ratios, typically much lower ratios of carbon 14 to carbon in artifacts that were made around that time, that's going to appear artificially older. I'll give an example. I mentioned this podium probably has, you know, one carbon 14 atom for every trillion carbon atoms in it. We'll say we found a a piece of wood that for whatever reason it only had one carbon-14 atom for every 32 trillion carbon atoms. So instead of one in a trillion, we had one in every 32 trillion. Well, 32 happens to be 2 to the fifth power. So that would mean I could date this podium, and I would say, well, it's five half-lives old. And so I would be coming out with a date, you know, somewhere around 28,000 years, when in reality this is, you know, probably, you know, well under, I don't know, 20, 30 years old at the most, probably less than that, you know, when the wood for this podium was cut. But it'd be because I was making a wrong assumption on the initial carbon-14 to carbon ratio. And so that's the primary assumption. Another assumption that could come into play would be the change in radioactive decay rates, you know, just the change in decay rates both during creation week and during the flood. That would also could also greatly affect that ratio. But what it really comes down to is the assumption that we know what the ratio was when that tree or, you know, however that piece of wood was dropped, whatever the carbon containing component, I guess you'd say, or organism was. The big assumption is that we knew when, you know, we knew what that ratio of carbon 14 to carbon was. And then, of course, after that, we would assume that ever since that time, the decay rate had not changed significantly. A few other assumptions that could be made. But again, the main one is that somehow we know what that original ratio was. If something was from 500 years, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, we're actually probably pretty confident in that. But when you get back close to the last major non-uniformitarian event, you get back close to the flood, that's when we have just tremendous uncertainty about that ratio was. So, and again, happy to talk about any of these after the session. I'm trying to let Jeff let me get away from the microphone.
There's one more here.
Okay.
Okay. If carbon dating is not valid, are other isotopes or other elements used to date things? And again, you did allude to this, but you might summarize. Are other isotopes or other elements used to date things?
Okay, so carbon dating, you know, is even the evolutionists will say that it's only good up to, you know, maybe 100,000 years at the outside. You know, and so you really, when you start having these extremely old ages, you know, quoted, you know, get into the billions of years, you can't use carbon-14. No one would claim you could use carbon-14. That is actually a way to know where a person's coming from, you know, how they refer to it. If they come out and say, well, hasn't carbon dating proven the Earth is billions of years old? You know, that's, you'll probably need to start a little, you know, start back a little bit and just explain some of the differences. And so the other methods of radiometric dating, they have the same issues. It's all dependent on the assumptions. It's dependent not only on the, you know, say it's a rock, the composition of the rock, but it's also dependent on the assumptions associated with the, you know, the say the ratio of isotopes that we find now in the rock. But most of the ones that are very old, to me, the evidence is pointing towards more that was a change in the decay rate of those isotopes. And that's, again, when we talk about the helium retention in the zircons. On the one hand, to me, it's a reasonable assumption when a zircon forms, it's mostly uranium. You don't have a, you know, certain uranium-lead ratio in that zircon. Now, I could be wrong. And if you had that when it was formed, that would also have a huge effect on how we dated that. But assuming, you know, it was mostly, you know, fairly pure uranium in that zircon, and then that uranium had to decay to lead, then I have, you know, two ways of trying to determine how old that zircon was. One is I just measure the ratio of the uranium to lead, and I can use that same decay equation that we showed in the presentation to, you know, back out how long has that uranium been decaying to lead. And then I can also look at how much helium is still retained in that zircon, because again, U-238 going down to lead-206, you release 8 helium atoms. And so I have those two methods. And so with those assumptions, I want to stress again, these are all based on assumptions. You typically can say, well, you know, there's a lot of uranium, relatively, a lot of uranium that's turned into lead in that zircon, but there's also a lot of helium still in that zircon. And so the straightforward conclusion from that is, yes, a lot of uranium has decayed into lead, and it had to happen relatively recently. It had to happen within the last few thousand years. I know the uranium decayed to lead because I can measure the ratio. And again, I'm assuming it was relatively pure uranium at the start. So that is an assumption. Some people would disagree with that assumption, and they might be right. But that is one assumption that goes in it. But then the other one I can actually measure. I can measure how fast helium is going to diffuse out of that zircon. And so by measuring the amount of helium left in the zircon, that's actually a very good, that's actually almost a more defensible measurement. And so again, I know that it appears that a lot of decay occurred, but it also had to occur fairly recently. And so with all of the dating methods, there are assumptions, and that's one of the things I wanted to drive home. No one questions the ability to accurately measure some of these ratios. No one questions the ability to accurately measure the carbon-14 to carbon ratio. The point of discussion is, what are the assumptions? Do I assume, make biblically consistent assumptions, or do I make, atheistic assumptions, or assumptions that basically contradict the Bible? One way I like to think about it is, if I assume the Bible is wrong, I can use carbon dating to prove the Bible is wrong. But that's circular reasoning. It's no proof at all. And if I make biblically consistent assumptions, then what I get from things like carbon dating, which of course ties directly to the genealogies, is very biblically consistent. And so that's, I think, why this is a favorite area for atheists to attack Christians on, is because it's not a case like some of the things Dr. DeWeese said, where, I can go into the lab and I can show there's no way evolution is happening. It's not this one's a little more complicated. And so typically an atheist or an evolutionist, they try to steer away from where true science can be applied. Because when true science can be applied, it comes down on the Christian side. When you get into these areas where there are assumptions, and it's just a question of who can make the most eloquent case for their assumptions, that's where the atheists feel they have a better chance of attacking the Bible.
Yeah, so assumptions is such a big thing in this. You remember in Mike's presentation, he showed that chart where one specimen was being dated with three different techniques, and not only did they not agree, if you noticed the scale, they didn't agree by hundreds of millions of years. And I was talking to Dr. Kurt Wise, who's a Harvard paleontologist, and he said that is always the case. If you use multiple methods on any one specimen, they never agree. They're always off by millions and millions of years. And one of the reasons you know that something's wrong is it ultimately comes down to these assumptions. And the three big assumptions that they're using in the radiometric dating techniques, especially outside of the radiocarbon one, rubidium, strontium, and uranium, lead, and so forth, are, number one, they assume the specimen was originally completely composed of the parent element, which, from a creationist perspective, you can't make that assumption. God could have created daughter elements at the very beginning, giving an immediate appearance of age to any rock that you might date. Because if there is a potential use for a daughter element, you would expect he would potentially create daughter elements. You assume a constant decay rate, and Mike addressed that and showed, for example, the ultrasonic cavitation that's been shown to increase the decay rate by a factor 10,000. He pointed out the rotation of the sun can actually affect these decay rates. The minute you recognize those two assumptions can't hold, you've totally obliterated those two dating techniques. They also assume, as a third one, that specimen you're dating is a closed system. It hasn't been affected by any outside activity. So leaching, for example, which is known to be a common problem when you're dating a specimen that has lead in it. This is a major problem. And so if you've got material from another rock that is leaching into this specimen over here, it can give it the appearance of being a different age than it is. So these are major assumptions, and that affects any dating technique that they use in these evolutionary scenarios. One other question for Mike I saw here, which I happen to know your material on this, and I like your take on this. Why is the addition of dark matter used to defend evolution? What's that about?
Oh, okay, a lot of reasons we evolutionists need to have dark matter, and it's really just to avoid fatal contradictions between what we observe and what the Big Bang would predict. And so, like a lot of us grew up thinking that we have these big clouds of gas, and then that gas would condense and form a star. Well, we've known all along that doesn't work. And so the way to make it work is you have to have some dark matter. And that dark matter has to clump up, and that dark matter can't observe it. That's one thing that's beautiful about it. So you have no observational evidence for it, but that dark matter provides the gravity needed to cause that cloud to collapse. And so you can go out to like the Lick Observatory. I mean, all the secular websites, they'll readily admit that, somehow after the Big Bang, this stuff that we have no idea what it is started to clump together, and that, then stars coalesce around that. It explains, it breaks the inconsistency between what we observe and what the Big Bang would predict. And so a lot of things, dark energy is also very important to the evolution. You have to have dark energy to explain the observations that we have. Now a few things. One is Right now, 96% of the universe has to be dark matter and dark energy. And so think of what we're saying here. We have 4% that we can actually observe, you know, 4% observational evidence. To keep there from being this fatal contradiction between what we observe and what the Big Bang would predict, we have to add in about 23% dark matter and about 73% dark energy. And so I have my observations here, and then I'll just say, have all these fudge factors here, and then I have what my theory predicts. And so the problem with looking at a issue that way is it literally does not matter what my observations are, and it does not matter what my theory predicts. If I'm allowed to put in that level of fudge factor, I can make any set of observations. I can pretend any set of observations I want supports any theory I want. And so that's really an important way of viewing this. And when people say, well, the Big Bang's not scientific, it goes against science, well, a lot of reasons for that. Some of the implications of the current model of the Big Bang are just, you know, they're just beyond absurd, and it's fun to walk through, you know, to the conclusion of where things go. But just the first one to think about is, if I'm allowed to make up 96% of the universe, and again, it's things I don't have to be able to observe, can't observe dark matter, can't observe dark energy. I claim I observe the effects of dark matter and dark energy, but I'm not observing the effects. I just know what the effects would need to be to make the Big Bang work. And so that's a very important distinction. We say, oh, we can map dark matter. We don't map dark matter. We can't see it. But what we know is all the places dark matter would have to be invoked to somehow match our observations and keep the Big Bang theory intact. And so the takeaway is, again, if I'm allowed to do that, it does not matter what my observations are. It does not matter what my theory is. I can take any set of observations and pretend they support any theory I want. Go back to a math analogy. If someone says, well, X plus Y equals 100, what does X equal? Well, the answer, X can be anything I want. You know, if you say X is 20, you're absolutely right. Y is 80. If I say X is negative 20, you're absolutely right. Y is 120. You know, X is 50, you're absolutely right. Y is 50. It just totally doesn't matter because you have enough variables there to make the adjustment. And so that's, it's not just dark matter, it's dark energy, it's inflation. They come up with things like, I think there's dark flow, there's dark light, but they're just made up fudge factors to try to justify this theory. And so if you get a chance to look into it more, one of my favorite ones, this is one they're struggling with, and they're doing research at major universities, is if the universe is finely tuned as it is, could just pop into existence, it's actually almost, they'll say infinitely, but you can't really, almost infinitely more likely that just a brain would pop into existence rather than a whole universe. Okay, and so you think about it, they're purely materialistic. They don't think we have a spirit. And that's, of course, why if we don't have a spirit, then you had no choice to be here this morning. Your several trillion atoms just all chemically reacted to make you come here, so I feel bad for you. But, you know, yeah, but anyway, so forget the free will. But since they don't have free will, we're just chemical. Well, you look at just a brain with, in their opinion, the atoms structured to give certain, you know, memories. It's much more likely for just a brain to pop out of the chaos than for an entire universe. And so the probability becomes about one that you guys are all just brains that have popped out of the chaos with the structure needed to give you the memories that you think you have. I'm not really here. You know, I'm just an imagination of your chemicals. But I mean, it gets really absurd really fast. But it's called Boltzmann brains. And you go out, and it's interesting. Obviously people are trying to explain their way out of it, but you can't, you know, because that becomes the implication. So you get a lot of absurdities from things like the Big Bang also, because they're trying to have this random, you know, you talk about multiverses and maybe there's an infinite number of universes. You get a lot of absurdities coming in play. But I would just really go back to just remembering, if I'm allowed to make up 96% of the universe, it doesn't matter what my observations are. It doesn't matter what my theory is. I can pretend any set of observations supports any theory I want. And I tried to go long-winded so he'd stop asking me questions. So.
And you've also brought up in some of your other material that there's some recent models that have been developed that are not creation-based or not Christian-based that say that if you were, for example, to throw out the Copernican principle, that assumption that the Earth is not in a special place, and instead assume, you know, what if the Earth was relatively close to the center of the universe in kind of a special place? It eliminates the need for some of these big fudge factors.
So that's a good point. The only reason we need to have 73% of the universe be dark energy is because from an evolutionist standpoint, we're not allowed to be any place special. And they, you know, again, fancy name, we talked about that, you know, give it a scientific sounding name to make people think it's credible. So they call it the Copernican principle. And that says, you know, what we see, we have to assume we're in a random location. And so you can't assume that our observations are based on us being in a particular spot. Now, I really can't figure that one out. They seem to feel that if we're in a specific location, that's too strong evidence for God, so you're not allowed to consider it. And I'm not sure why they can't get around that one. I mean, they actually, I think from an atheistic standpoint, they probably could get around that one. But as Jeff said, if we are in a specific location, you can completely eliminate the need for dark energy. And so boy, that's getting rid of 73% fudge factor. You think that would be huge, but you're not even allowed to consider that. What's also interesting, if we happen to be in that location, making very biblically consistent assumptions, there would have been enough gravitational time dilation during creation week that you would see the universe appear the way it does from an Earth that's just a few thousand years old. And I'm not sure if the people that are opposed or promoting Copernican principle, I'm not sure if they're aware of that. Maybe they are. But one of the huge implications is if we are in a specific location, it's actually a very good way to explain why we see the universe the way it is, again, from an Earth that's just a few thousand years old. So it's very fascinating, but it's, to me, it's frustrating how much we're letting these non-scientific ideas, like the Copernican principle, how much we're letting that drive our research. Because I think it has really been a setback to cosmology. It could ultimately be a setback to our, you know, just our space exploration, our technology development. There's a lot of other examples we could give. Obviously, belief in vestigial organs, belief in junk DNA. Those were all setbacks to one degree or another. But I think from a understanding the universe standpoint, just a tremendous setback because of our commitment to atheism and just these non-scientific ideas such as the Copernican principle.
I think we're done with you, Mike.
All right. I was gonna go another.
There were a couple questions about so if dinosaurs and humans coexisted, were they on the ark? What's the deal there? I'll actually touch on that in the session tomorrow evening. So for the sake of time, we're not going to mess with that one. There was the question, when was the estimated time of the flood? And there's a reason why we use a range. We'll say that the earth is 6,000 to 8,000, sometimes 6,000 to 10,000 years. And that is because in Genesis 10 and 11, there is some wiggle room that may be there. We've got some articles on our website that would address that question more. But you don't have time in there for evolutionary theory, for eons of time or anything like that. You can nail it down within a pretty small range, which is why we'll say 6,000 to 8,000 years. If you take the genealogies just in a surface way, you would say that it was about 2350 BC. But that could be expanded potentially to 3,000 or 4,000 BC without a problem, without that contradicting the biblical time frame. And as we've been showing, the science has no problem with that either. But anyway, go to our website on that particular question. We deal with that on apologeticspress.org. All right, Brandon, you're up. How do you answer questions concerning the age of the universe using the time light travels from other stars or galaxies?
All right, so the question is addressing the fact that we look out into the universe with our telescopes and we see very large, very distant objects. And so if light travels at a particular speed and these are distant objects, then does that tell us that there is an ancient age to the universe that we're in? And tomorrow I'm going to touch on an analogous issue that there is with the Big Bang, a similar sort of light travel question and conundrum for that model. There's not necessarily a direct resolution to it. There are various models, various understandings of light traveling. Light is an entity. It's got wavelength, it's got energy, it's got parameters that are specific to it. And some of the suggestions or thoughts is if we were designed, if we were placed into a universe, then what's around us plays a very crucial role in our existence and our life. We would need to see it, to study it, to understand it, to look at it, to participate with it. And so one of the thoughts is that it was created here. It is an entity all its own, and it was created here with the intent of us being able to study and see. In addition to that, We're talking about large amounts of space. We're talking about relativity. We're talking about spreading things out. If it was created and put here and expanded into place, then the light itself would be in that expansion of the universe. So there are a couple of creation models and theories by creationists that use Einstein's equations and general relativity to talk about the expansion of space and its effect on light and on the travel of light. Could that resolve a distance discrepancy? You know, we look at the window of time that we've been living and measuring. How long has the speed of light been known? Just a few hundred years, okay? We have this very small window, a few data points. Could light have had some sort of difference? What's interesting is we know that light travels at different speeds given different contexts. If you shine light through a glass or through a crystal, what happens to that light? It refracts, it bends. That refraction and bending is a physical change in the speed of light traveling through that medium. And so the idea of, well, light has to be absolutely constant. We know, well, it's not constant given different contexts. And so can we generate a model that incorporates different contexts or different travel pathways for the light? We know that gravity bends light. Is there an effect of gravitation in all of the mass of the universe? So there is no, you know, nice, clean, you know, few line sentence that resolves for us that idea, but that's really where the understanding of we are here to investigate. We are seeing parameters, but we have to know the limits of the parameters that we're measuring. And so it's not a conflict when we see that there are different models that take into account those different aspects and can generate that similar results given what we know and what we don't know.
All right. What about life on other planets, Brandon?
Oh, yes, life on other planets. That's the common description is, okay, evolution is assumed to be true. It happened on this planet. We are one, you know, we are a planet around a star. There are hundred billion stars in our galaxy. There are 100 billion galaxies in our universe. Then just by statistics, if it happened here, it must have happened everywhere else. Well, I believe that assumption of evolution had to happen here, you know, that assumption of that being true, I think has been discussed today, right? Of the complexity and the statistics really behind that. And so making that leap from, well, it happened here, so it must have happened in lots of other places. That's a really big leap. The next vantage point is the fact that when you look at our planet with the planets that we know, okay, look at our own solar system, okay? Mercury, life isn't going to exist there. Venus, right, Earth's twin, super hot, super dense atmosphere, absolutely life is not living there. Mars, right? We have had Mars rovers on the surface of Mars for decades now. No evidence of life. You look at Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune, all gas giants, life's not going to live there. So when we look at our own solar system of 8 planets, we go, wow, Earth is fairly unique. There are lots of planets that are found around other stars. They're called extrasolar planets. Okay, so they are bodies that are orbiting another star, not the sun. But they fall into that same issue that the realm of life, the parameters that are needed for life to exist are very narrow. And so immediately off the top, you can cut away the vast majority, if not only a handful, of planets around other stars. No way would support that life. And so the idea of life just being prolific and existing all across our universe, it doesn't hold up to what we know of the functioning and usefulness and needs of life. And we know life in various forms. And so we're not just talking ourselves as humans. We're talking all sorts of different life, even the life that lives at the bottom of the ocean near hydrothermal vents. What it needs to survive is very complicated and complex, even for its case. And so when we look to other places, no, that it wouldn't exist in other places either. from a biblical view, what would a creationist look at and expect? We read about the specialness of Earth, the care and concern that was placed into putting Earth into the right circumstances for life to be, and what was the prophecy, right, given to Eve, that of her seed would come this promised person, right, who would defeat Satan, defeat death. Jesus came in our form. He didn't come in E.T.'s form or some other form. He came here, wants to die for all. So the creationist viewpoint is, you know, looking at it, our saving and our connection in a spiritual sense is very direct to Jesus Christ. And you know, it's different and excludes that concept other places. We're not going to be dogmatic about that, but the science and the Bible point to it not being the case that we live in a universe like that.
Good. So I think you're going to have some biblical conundrums if we try to argue from a biblical perspective that there would be intelligent or soul life elsewhere in the universe. You're going to have some biblical issues with that. But just the idea potentially that there could be life that is not intelligent elsewhere is not necessarily anti-biblical as far as I've ever been able to tell, which is why Branyan said we don't want to be dogmatic about that. But I haven't seen anything in the Bible that would say there couldn't be life elsewhere that God put out there for us to discover. But intelligent life that has a soul, that's a different question, you know, created in the image of God, that sort of thing. All right, thanks, Branyan. We're running out of time. We're going to have to fly through here. Joe is going to answer one question. I don't even remember what it was. I already handed it to him. You go ahead and read it, Joe. Go for it.
Yeah, there was a question to the effect of if evolution is a theory, how did it end up being taught as like it is a fact? And what we have to understand is that science, as we know it, is a pursuit of knowledge. It's one source of knowledge. It's not the only source of knowledge. But there are some who hold science up as the source of knowledge. And so the approach to it is naturalism, a methodological naturalism, which is the idea that we can only seek naturalistic answers to our questions. That's an assumption. And now, as to this particular question, what we have to understand is that evolutionary theory has taken a lot of observations of the natural world and brought them together, like we talked about just a little bit ago, into an idea that there is mutation and natural selection that brought about the life that we have today. And that paradigm has been so convincing to so many for quite a long time that a lot of scientists believe it, and it has become institutionalized to the point that it's in all the textbooks, and so it is taught as the reigning paradigm. Now, I believe that it's a paradigm that's become being undermined, in particular by more recent discoveries in genetics, like the discovery that essentially there is no junk DNA. All of our DNA, at least over 80% of it, has assignable biochemical function. And if 80% of our genome has assignable biochemical function, there's not a lot of leftover vestigial space for evolution to have occurred. And in fact, it implies that it's a design system rather than an evolved system. So I understand, I think, where this question is going, but understand the system we're in, that most people who have maybe a naturalistic perspective and have gravitated toward science have taken on evolution as their worldview, and they've ended up overpopulating. They're most of our scientists. So they write most of the textbooks. They write most of the research papers. And so everything we see in science gets interpreted through one particular paradigm. But what I want our young people to understand is that that's not the only paradigm. There's another way we can view the evidence. There's another way we can interpret that evidence. And I think we can do so that's in accordance with scientific principles. But we have to understand that science can only ask and answer certain questions. Science can only ask and answer certain types of questions. And it can't give us questions about ultimate origins. So I can't use science to prove definitively that God is the creator. But according to Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, Paul argues that we can see God's divine attributes in his creation, in the things that have been made. And in fact, he argues that that is so that the unbeliever is without excuse. In other words, there's so much evidence in what has been made that we're created system, that we give evidence of God's divine attributes. And I think that's a really powerful thing to consider, that he has designed us such that we can see his design in us and know that he is real. And I think that's the case. But again, we have to understand there are different forms of knowing. Scientific knowledge is only one form of knowing. And there are other forms of knowing. We have intuition. We've got authoritative knowledge. We've got logical or mathematical knowledge. All of these other forms of knowing have to be brought in together. And we have to use all of those to make decisions about things, rather than saying that science is the source of knowledge. It's one among many sources. And we have to bring all those things together and consider their meaning. So, okay.
Is that good? You know, someone asked along, you can sit down, Joe, but someone asked along that line, why don't most scientists agree with you? And it's true that most of the naturalistic community does not agree with what we're talking about here this week, and there's no question about that. And so Joe touched on why that would be. The Bible has a lot to say about that. But what I would say is I see a lot of atheists using that as an argument, as though because most scientists believe this, therefore it must be true. And that's just not, that's a logical fallacy to say that. I mean, how many things have the majority of people believed in the past that ultimately ended up being false? I mean, truth has nothing to do with how many people believe it. The question is, what does the evidence say? And what we're trying to do this weekend is present the evidence. And the evidence does not support naturalistic evolution. It doesn't matter how many people, even if one person makes that point, that's all that matters. Truth is not contingent on how many people believe it. And so, yeah, there are fewer creation scientists. We come under a lot of fire for the beliefs that we have. But hey, we're looking at the evidence and we're presenting it to you. And we're not allowing ourselves to be swayed by the majority or consensus view. To us, that doesn't really matter. The truth doesn't matter about consensus. So that is an important thing to get. Also, a question was asked, is faith, which they define as belief without evidence, a reasonable method to use when determining whether or not something is true? And I would say no. I think all of us would say no, because that's not how the Bible defines this. You know, the Christendom at large has a total misunderstanding of what faith is. And they say it is believing without evidence, or even when common sense tells you not to believe something, you're accepting it like a leap of faith. That's not what the Bible teaches. 1 Thessalonians 5:21 says, you should test or prove all things, hold fast that which is good. Acts 17:11, the Bereans are called noble-minded because they didn't accept just everything they were being taught, even though it could have been apostles teaching them. Instead, they did what? They searched the scriptures daily. They made sure there was evidence. In fact, Jesus said in John 10, don't believe in me if I don't prove what I'm saying with evidence. I mean, so this is not a biblical idea that our faith is not based on evidence. That's not what we believe. God has said, you've got evidence and you better look at the evidence and come to the right conclusion. But thankfully, he's presented us so much evidence that Romans 1:20 tells us there will be no excuse in the end. You will not be able to stand before God and say, God, there just wasn't enough evidence. It is without excuse to come to the conclusion that there has to be a being outside of the box. And so we look at the evidence, and our faith is based on that. Now, along that lines, another person asked, so why is the biblical creation model more likely to be true than other supernatural explanations when they may be possible if allowed their own correction factors? And really, this is getting at another one of the questions we're getting a lot at AP. So, for example, the material I presented last night, where I'm talking about the origin of the ilum, the cosmic egg. Really, what I proved is that there has to be something outside of the box, but I did not say which thing is outside of the box, which God is there. How do we know that it's the God of the Bible and it's not Allah, it's not Buddha? You know, how do we know that we're right? And a biology professor came up and asked me that after a seminar a few years back when I was in Arkansas, and I gave him the same answer that hopefully all of us would. The difference between the biblical model and any other model is that the Bible, unlike all other material on earth, has characteristics that humans could not have produced. It is divine. And we got lots of materials that emphasize that at AP. So we have positive evidence of a book that has divine characteristics that sets it apart from any other model. And so therefore, the things that the Bible says about the truth with regard to our origin and so forth has more sway than, you know, the Babylonian account of origins and so forth. That would make it different. So that is why the biblical creation model is more likely to be true than other supernatural explanations. All right, there is another question here that's a long one, and ultimately, you know, we all actually powwowed briefly about this one because we would all We all did at least come to agreement about, I think, one thing. Let me read this to you. When I speak with people who do not believe in God, most often they just like to say, there's just too much evidence of evolution to even argue the creation model. They have just believed that all the smart people must be right without personal investigation. Which, by the way, that whole idea, all the smart people must be right, that's another logical fallacy. We don't believe something because the smart people believe it. That's not truth, just because somebody smart believes something. What's the best introductory challenge or material to present to try to open a door of doubt in evolution to these people? How do you start a dialogue? And I think all of us pretty much agreed, it really depends on who you're talking to. You know, you got to know something about that person, ask them some questions to figure out where they're coming from in order to know the kind of thing that's really plaguing them, as to whether it may be somebody that you talk to them about the origin of the universe, the ultimate origin, that would answer it for them. It may be that they're hung up on Darwinian evolution. And so maybe you got to talk to them about the origin of life or the origin of species, as Joe was talking about. It just kind of depends on who you're talking to. I don't know that I've ever had one route myself that worked on everybody. It just kind of depended on who you're talking to and where they're coming from, the questions they have that are plaguing them. Some people, it might be something more like, you know, evil and suffering, pain and suffering. How do you deal with that? How can you have this all-loving God that allows these things to happen? And you've got to deal with that before you can really address any of these other things we're talking about, which, again, we got plenty of materials to deal all this with this. It's not any kind of big deal. All right, it is noon, guys. I think we're done. Appreciate your attention. Appreciate your attendance at this. Tomorrow morning.